Thank you very much, Kurt. And thank you for the invitation to speak today at this Essential Treasurer event. There's a lot happening in the area of payments and financial infrastructure that I could speak on today, but this is my last speech before retiring from the Reserve Bank at the end of the year. So I thought I'd focus on the development that has generated the most discussion, conversation, and debate in the nearly 10 years that I've spent as head of payments policy. And that's the emergence of distributed ledger technology, cryptocurrencies and stable coins, and the prospective emergence of central bank digital currencies. There have been some fascinating developments in this area. So today I'm going to give you an overview of the different types of digital assets, some of the differences between them, what roles they could play in the future, and some of the policy issues they raise. Now, a wide range of investors, from households to hedge funds, appear to believe that there is a significant role for cryptocurrencies as investments. This has been accompanied by the launch in various jurisdictions of crypto versions of financial products associated with the more traditional asset classes. For example, futures contracts, exchange traded funds, and even micro futures contracts to make smaller investments in cryptocurrencies more accessible. And some mainstream financial institutions are providing their customers with access to crypto assets. At the same time, for reasons that I'll touch on, much of the official sector globally remains skeptical of developments in the cryptocurrency market. The recent boom in this area is perhaps best illustrated by the fact that Dogecoin, a cryptocurrency that was started as a joke in late 2013, had an implied market capitalization as high as $88 billion in June this year. It's since fallen back to around $31 billion, which makes it the eighth largest cryptocurrency by market capitalization. And the Shiba Inu token, which appears to be equally free of any useful function, is currently the ninth largest cryptocurrency with a market capitalization of around $26 billion. While cryptocurrencies have clearly captured the attention of many, no doubt fueled by influencers and celebrity tweets, it's unclear how widely held they are. But some surveys have claimed that around 20% of the Australian population hold cryptocurrencies. And one claimed that Dogecoin alone was held by as much as 5% of Australians. I must say that I find these statistics somewhat implausible. I can't help thinking that the online surveys they're based on might be unrepresentative of the population. We've got some experience on survey issues from the Reserve Bank's 3-yearly consumer payment survey, where we contract a survey firm to have 1,000 or more adults record every payment they make for a week. And we find there are important segments of the population, most notably older people, those who live in regional areas, and those who do not regularly access the internet, that online survey panels simply do not capture well. Our experience is that it takes a lot of work to do a really good survey of the population. So while it's hard to point to any firmer evidence on cryptocurrency holdings by Australians, some of the estimates out there are extremely surprising and could be symptomatic of the hype and misinformation in this area. But having raised questions about how widely cryptocurrencies are held, I probably should offer a disclosure, namely that I've had a cryptocurrency wallet since June 2014. After all, part of my job is to try to understand new payment instruments and technologies. So my initial purchase was a small amount of Bitcoin, and I've used that for a few small transfers and even a purchase of at a cafe that accepted Bitcoin, and then to diversify into some Ether in August 2018. But I should stress the amounts in question are still pretty small. I'll now get a bit more specific about the various types of new digital assets or payment instruments, which can be classified into three broad groups. Cryptocurrencies include a broad range of privately issued digital assets. They have their own currency unit, and they're not denominated in the currency of any sovereign issuer. They use cryptography to store the record of transactions and the ownership of digital coins on a digital ledger. This ledger is distributed and synchronized across a number of nodes or computers, rather than relying on a central party to operate the system. Bitcoin's the most prominent implementation of a cryptocurrency protocol, but many thousands of variations have emerged. Cryptocurrencies have got no intrinsic value, typically do not have any issuer standing behind them, and they rely on users' trust in the software protocol that controls the system. The term cryptocurrency may suggest they're a form of money. However, the consensus is that existing cryptocurrencies do not have the key attributes of money, which is why some people prefer the term crypto assets. As many have noted, they're rarely used or accepted as a means of payment, at least in everyday life. They're not used as a unit of account, and their prices can be very volatile, so they're a very poor store of value. In Australia, the effect of the Currency Act is that cryptocurrencies are not legal tender, but this doesn't prevent their use where both parties wish to do so. Now, the second group of new digital assets are the so-called stable coins. These are a type of token specifically designed to minimize price volatility, typically against a sovereign currency such as the US dollar. This is to make them more money-like and attractive as a store of value or a method of payment. One way that their promoters try to maintain a stable value is by holding assets that back the coins on issue. However, these backing arrangements to date have had varying degrees of credibility. This has been especially relevant in the case of Tether, the largest stablecoin by market capitalization, which was recently fined $41 million by the CFTC for misleading statements regarding its assets being fully backed. Thirdly, central bank digital currency, or CBDC, is a potential new form of digital money that would be a liability of or a claim on the central bank. A retail or a general purpose CBDC would be like a digital version of cash, presumably accessed via wallets on phones and possibly through purpose-built devices like smart cards. There could also be wholesale CBDC, which, similar to settlement accounts at central banks, would be accessible only to a more limited range of participants. Like cash and settlement balances, the unit of account of the CBDC would be the sovereign currency, which is also known as fiat currency. The CBDC would be convertible at par, that is one for one, with other forms of money, and in all likelihood, it would also be specified as legal tender. While CBDCs would be issued by the central bank, it's generally expected that the customer-facing activities involved in distributing them to users would be undertaken by private sector entities. Implementations of CBDCs could use distributed ledger technology, but this need not be the case, and they might instead rely on more traditional databases. This will apparently be the case for the planned Chinese CBDC. Now, there are many ways to distinguish between the three types of new digital assets: CBDCs, cryptocurrencies, and stablecoins. But there are two particular dimensions that I think are worth highlighting. First, in terms of denomination and backing. There's a spectrum here, starting with cryptocurrencies, which have their own unit with no reference to any fiat currency and no asset backing, so that any value that they might have is determined purely by what, if anything, others will pay for them. Then there are stablecoins, which are typically denominated in fiat currencies, or they aim for stability against fiat currencies, and they're backed by assets that are supposed to ensure their redeemability at par. And there are CBDCs, which are denominated in fiat or sovereign currencies and are fully convertible at par into other forms of money. Now, a second distinguishing dimension is in terms of governance and technology. Here, CBDCs would clearly have centralized or permissioned governance arrangements, as do some stablecoin arrangements. But this is typically not the case for permissionless cryptocurrencies, where there is a pre-existing software protocol for the system, and any governance relies on some form of consensus emerging to change that protocol. And transaction verification would also be quite different. In cryptocurrencies, entities compete to verify transactions, including via proof-of-work mining competitions. By contrast, CBDCs and stablecoins would likely rely on a smaller number of trusted entities to verify transactions. The implied market value of all crypto assets on issue is currently around $2.6 trillion. Bitcoin, the original cryptocurrency, which is essentially a simple token on a blockchain with no other functionality, remains the largest, with a market capitalization around $1.1 trillion. However, its share of total market capitalization has been falling with the emergence of stable coins, as well as the growing interest in tokens associated with blockchains that use so-called smart contracts and can provide greater functionality than Bitcoin. Smart contracts are self-executing computer code running on a DLT platform, a distributed ledger platform, that automatically perform various functions. You can think of them as if-then statements that allow parties to enter into agreements without the need to trust one another or rely on a central party. They enable all sorts of new applications, such as decentralized finance or DeFi, decentralized autonomous organizations, and non-fungible tokens, which I won't attempt to cover today, given our time constraint. Now, looking ahead, you've probably heard the old saying that's been attributed to Niels Bohr, Yogi Berra, and many others, that it's tough to make predictions, especially about the future. Nevertheless, I thought I might try my hand today with a scenario of how things might play out for the various types of new digital assets. I can certainly imagine that there will be future use cases for distributed ledger technology or DLT, including where there are significant benefits in terms of resilience from having multiple instances of a ledger rather than a centralized one. And there may be use cases where there are inefficient legacy business processes where many parties are involved, and it would be more efficient to have different parties all able to write to a distributed ledger. Now, these distributed ledgers may well make significant use of smart contracts for easily automated functions. There might also be all sorts of use cases for decentralized finance or DeFi. But neither smart contracts nor DeFi more broadly necessarily require the use of any particular cryptocurrency or token. Plus, I do wonder if there will be as much of a shift to peer-to-peer transactions as seemed to be envisaged by some DeFi proponents. For example, when Australians hold cryptocurrencies, they usually do it through an intermediary via a hosted or a custodial wallet. Typically, they don't do it via unhosted or self-custodial wallets, where if they lose their private keys, they've lost their funds forever. So I suspect there'll still be a significant role for some form of intermediaries, even in a world where finance is more decentralized than it is currently. But now let us imagine a world where all sorts of financial assets, bonds, equities, derivatives, commodities, etc., can be tokenized and transacted on blockchains. What payment instrument will be used to settle the transactions? I'm going to focus on two aspects of this choice. First, it seems highly likely that entities and individuals will want to pay with and receive financial assets that have a high degree of stability of value. I expect it will be rare that both parties to a transaction, especially a high value one, will want settlement to occur via payment in some highly volatile cryptocurrency. Over the past year, for Bitcoin, the standard deviation of its daily change in value has been about 4.25%. And the standard deviation of the 5-day change in its value has been around 9.5%. For Ether, these numbers are around 5.5% and 12.5%. So I expect that tokenized asset transactions will typically be settled in fiat currencies, such as the Australian dollar, the US dollar, the euro, et cetera. And I would expect that the fiat instruments used will be riskless or near riskless. That is, they're likely to be CBDCs or very safe stable coins issued by regulated entities. And second, I expect that the entities transacting on the blockchain will want to ensure that they can do so with settlement that is clear and final. That is the standard in the financial market infrastructures that settle these transactions today. And it seems likely that market participants and regulators will expect that standard to apply where transactions involving tokenized financial assets are being settled on a blockchain platform. Currently, transaction verification in existing cryptocurrencies with their public blockchains and proof of work consensus is probabilistic. For example, once a transaction is included in a block, the standard rule of thumb is that it takes up to 60 minutes before the party receiving Bitcoin can be highly confident of having received it. For Ether, this is much shorter, though the general point applies. But in permissioned networks involving trusted parties, as would likely be the case for CBDCs or regulated stablecoins, it should be feasible to come up with much more efficient consensus mechanisms. These could match the safety and certainty of existing delivery versus payment processes in the non-tokenized world. This could ensure that large institutions will have confidence in buying and selling tokenized assets. So I can imagine a future where, firstly, the establishment of strong regulatory frameworks for stablecoins could lead to issuance of stablecoins by highly rated entities. And secondly, where central banks could move towards issuing CBDCs. In either case, they would be denominated in fiat currencies, be safer than existing stablecoins, and would likely have faster, safer, and more efficient transaction verification mechanisms than most cryptocurrencies. So it is likely they would be viewed as superior instruments for the settlement of transactions in tokenized assets on distributed ledgers. So what role would there be for cryptocurrencies in this scenario? I think there are plausible scenarios where a range of factors could come together to significantly challenge the current fervor for cryptocurrencies, so that the current speculative demand could begin to reverse and much of the price increases of recent years could be unwound. Here are three possible factors. First, households might be less influenced by fads and a fear of missing out, and might start to pay more attention to warnings from securities regulators and consumer protection agencies about the risks of investing in something with no issuer, no backing, and highly uncertain value. Second, the very high use of energy involved in mining proof-of-work cryptocurrencies could attract greater attention from governments and policymakers. The most recent estimates from digieconomist.net put the annualized energy usage of the Bitcoin system at similar to that of Thailand, the world's 23rd largest economy in terms of energy consumption. Ethereum has been planning to switch to a less energy-intensive verification method for many years. However, for the time being, Ethereum's energy usage is estimated to be the equivalent of the Philippines, the 35th largest economy in terms of energy consumption. Together, energy consumption to run the Bitcoin and Ethereum systems is estimated to be close to the energy consumption of the world's 13th largest economy. And third, there could be greater focus on the anonymity or the near anonymity that many cryptocurrencies can offer and their potential use in facilitating financial crime and the black economy. Tax authorities and financial crime agencies could pay greater attention to transactions going through the on and off ramps that link cryptocurrencies to the traditional financial sector, for example, digital currency exchanges. So if there were to be global policy action to deal with some particular concerns about the use of cryptocurrencies, plus the arrival of new stablecoins and CBDCs that could safely meet the needs of a wide range of users, then existing cryptocurrencies might have only niche use cases at best. If so, and also reflecting that the relevant code is often open source, publicly available, and easily copied, it seems plausible that current valuations of many cryptocurrencies would not be sustained. Mark Carney, former governor of the Bank of Canada and the Bank of England, has made a very similar point. But given the significant possible role of CBDCs and stablecoins in payments in the future, the Reserve Bank and the official sector more broadly has been doing a lot of work in this area. There's considerable focus globally on CBDCs. Surveys from the Bank for International Settlements indicate that essentially all central banks are doing work in this area. The Central Bank of the Bahamas is the first central bank to have introduced a full-fledged CBDC, and the Eastern Caribbean Central Bank is following. In both cases, the focus is on improving financial inclusion. China is in the advanced stages of piloting an ERMB, or a digital yuan, for household use, and it seems increasingly likely to move to full issuance. However, no high-income economies have yet made the decision to issue a CBDC. Sweden and the euro area appear to be the jurisdictions thinking most seriously about a possible CBDC. However, in both cases, any decisions on possible issuance is probably a couple of years away. By contrast, the US Federal Reserve appears much less convinced of the case for a retail CBDC, with both the chair and a deputy chair having expressed skepticism recently. And one governor gave a speech in August that was entitled, CBDC, a solution in search of a problem, Fed officials have pointed to ongoing improvements in the existing payment system, the uncertain benefits of a CBDC, and new risks that it could introduce. They've also questioned the idea that the Fed needs to introduce a CBDC to compete with foreign CBDCs, cryptocurrencies, or stablecoins. Reserve Bank staff have also not been convinced to date that a strong policy case has emerged in Australia for a CBDC. The primary reason has been that Australia's existing electronic payment system already provides households and businesses with a wide range of safe, convenient, and low-cost payment services. The new payments platform, or the NPP, was a major upgrade to the payment system, allowing real-time, data-rich and easily addressed account-to-account payments that can be made on a 24/7 basis. The capability of the NPP has been highlighted in recent months, with its use to deliver more than 19 million COVID support payments, providing immediate value and mostly on weekends. Looking ahead, the NPP will be used to deliver incoming cross-border payments and could potentially be linked up with other fast payment systems to enable instant cross-border payments. And more broadly, much, if not all, of the innovation and new functionality that could potentially be enabled by a CBDC could, in principle, also be enabled by innovation based around commercial bank deposit accounts, e-money, or stablecoins. However, the bank acknowledges the argument being made internationally that with all the innovation that is occurring in the payments area, provision of a new digital form of central bank money for general purpose use could be important for safeguarding confidence in national monies and the role of fiat currencies at the heart of monetary, financial, and payment systems. In addition, there appears to be growing recognition that the network effects inherent in payments could result in large technology companies or payment schemes coming to dominate the payments industry. So there could be potential benefits arising from central banks issuing general purpose CBDCs that might be used by different types of payment providers to offer transfers between digital wallets of households and merchants. By introducing CBDCs, central banks would not be getting into the retail payments business. Rather, they would be providing a riskless and interoperable form of digital money that could potentially stimulate competition between private sector service providers. Given that the possibility that the balance could shift towards a case for issuance of retail CBDCs, the bank has been stepping up its CBDC research. Supporting the evolution of payments is one of six strategic focus areas in the bank's strategic plan, and research on CBDC is a key element of this. The bank is looking to do experiments around retail CBDC, and we're currently engaging with the new Digital Finance Cooperative Research Centre, or CRC, on possible projects. We're one of the 29 founding entities that will work through the CRC to explore the opportunities arising from the digitisation of assets. As regards wholesale CBDC, The bank has been conducting research on the technological and policy implications for several years, based on a view that it was more likely that a case for issuance could emerge. Our first proof of concept project was done in 2019. More recently, the bank has been working on Project Atom, which has been conducted with four external parties. This has extended our earlier proof of concept in a number of ways, including a tokenized financial asset and exploring the implication of DVP settlement on a distributed ledger technology platform. A report on this project will be published shortly. And currently, our staff are working on Project Dunbar, together with the Biz Innovation Hub and the central banks of Malaysia, Singapore, and South Africa. This project is looking at the possible use of CBDCs in cross-border payments. Turning now to stablecoins, the first point to note is that to date, there has been essentially no issue of Australian dollar stablecoins, nor use of them as a payment method in Australia. However, it is possible there could be a significant role for stablecoins in the settlement of transactions in tokenized assets, or that large retail-focused stablecoins could emerge. So it's important that a suitable regulatory framework is developed. If stablecoins are intended to be safe payment instruments and serve as alternatives to other forms of money, it's important for consumer protection and financial stability that they are appropriately regulated. So the bank and the other members of the Council of Financial Regulators, together with AUSTRAC and the ACCC, are involved in a working group that is considering the regulatory framework for crypto assets, including stablecoins. This work is building on the Council's earlier work on stored value facilities, including possible digital wallets using stablecoins. The CFR agencies have also been engaging with the international counterparts on the regulatory issues surrounding stablecoins and the potential risks to the financial system, especially from so-called global stablecoins, which are those that have the potential to scale rapidly and become widely used in a number of countries. One element of this work is a consultation by two of the international standard-setting bodies on the applicability of some existing international standards to stablecoin arrangements. Another example of the sharp focus on stablecoins internationally is the recent US report by the President's Working Group on Financial Markets. It called for comprehensive regulation and oversight of stablecoins to deal with risks from the potential for destabilizing runs, disruptions in the finance, in the payment system, and concentration of economic power. So as you all have seen from this quick tour, the digital asset space has provided no shortage of research, analysis, and policy work over the past decade, and it's been fascinating to be working at the Reserve Bank over this period. I can assure you that work on the future of payments will be a high priority for the bank in coming years, as part of its responsibility to ensure that there are safe forms of money that the public can trust to foster stability in Australia's monetary, financial, and payment systems. The bank will be continuing to work with the private sector and our international counterparts to ensure we stay abreast of innovations in the payment system. And there'll be significant work to be done with the other financial regulators and the Parliament to ensure that we have a fit-for-purpose regulatory framework for digital assets. It'll be fascinating to see how things evolve over the next decade. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks very much, Tony. Appreciate that. At this point, we've got one question from the audience. So I'll encourage everybody to please submit your questions. This is a fantastic opportunity to tap a really strong resource in this space. Just before I go to the audience question, I'm actually going to jump in with one of my own. So do cryptocurrencies and stable coins raise issues for financial stability and Australia's monetary sovereignty?
Well, that's a good question, Kurt, and it's one that we do get asked periodically. Let me first talk about cryptocurrencies. The first point is they're not widely used. And I can't see that happening. I can't see shops posting their prices in cryptocurrencies, or companies doing their annual reports in cryptocurrencies, or lots of people wanting to get paid in cryptocurrencies. So no, I don't view them as a threat to the Australian dollar or to our monetary sovereignty or to the Reserve Bank's ability to conduct monetary policy. And the links between the crypto economy and the traditional financial sector are currently quite limited. So we don't consider that crypto assets raise financial stability risks at present. Clearly, some individuals and entities who are long crypto have got significant risk in their own financial positions, but there would be very little risk to our overall financial stability. As regards stablecoins, I also find it hard to imagine a foreign currency stablecoin playing a major role in the Australian economy and our financial system. But I can imagine a significant role for Australian dollar stablecoins. But if their backing arrangements were not credible, you could have runs on the stablecoins and fire sales of the assets backing them, which could raise financial stability concerns. So I expect that any stablecoins that scale to any significant size and were to be used like money in the Australian economy would have to be regulated to high standards to reduce financial stability risks. But to the extent that they're denominated in Australian dollars and they're backed by high quality Australian dollar assets, I don't think they threaten our monetary sovereignty at all. Of course, stable coins that were issued by large technology companies might raise other concerns, for example, privacy concerns, but that'd be more an issue for other regulators.
Okay, thank you. So I've got a question here from Ivan, and he's asked, what is driving the Bitcoin boom?
Well, that's a good question. I think it's one that a lot of people have asked themselves. I think there is a plausible story that, that payments will be very different in the future. I have suggested to you that I don't necessarily buy the story that cryptocurrencies have got a major part in that future, but there are many people that do believe that that's the case. There is the argument that that Bitcoin is the new gold. Again, I'm not sure that I buy that. Gold's an interesting case, and people can obviously debate why it's so highly valued. But the fact is that there's only about, I think there's 118 elements in the periodic table, and only one of them has had a particular role as a store of value over the millennia. We can be pretty certain that lots of new precious metals are not going to be discovered. Now, I know there's the argument that there'll only ever be 21 million Bitcoin mined. But the Bitcoin protocol can be copied and has been copied many times. Depending on the estimate you look at, there's something like 8,000 cryptocurrencies. It's quite possible that another cryptocurrency will come to be viewed as superior to Bitcoin, or even that none of them will be viewed as having much value. Because when something's so easily copied, I think it's hard to put much value on it. So it's unlikely to last millennia like gold. So I find it surprising that Bitcoin has risen to current levels. And as I sort of alluded to in the talk, it's easy to imagine scenarios where it would have much less value than it currently does previously.
Okay. Also have a question from Ashish. I hope I've pronounced that correctly. How will regulations keep up with the rise of the metaverse, with the largest companies such as Facebook and Microsoft actively working to create virtual worlds with virtual commerce?
I might pass on that one. I think that's probably a sort of a whole of government question, or it's hard to focus too much on the payments aspect of that. But I would say, for example, that when Facebook's proposed Libra and then DM currency was first talked about, the relevant Australian regulators all got together. So we've had a lot of contact with ASIC, APRA, the ACCC, OIARC, I think is the privacy regulator. So I think you can be certain that the Australian regulatory agencies will come together to discuss the risks that are posed by large technology companies. If they, for example, want to get into payments, I suspect that this will get a lot of focus in Canberra as well. So I think it's a problem that we'll be able to find a solution to.
Okay. Also have a question from James. What is your view of commercial agreements created using smart contracts via Ethereum being implemented at scale?
As I said in the talk, I can imagine a future where smart contracts are used a lot. At its most simple form, a smart contract is simply an if-then statement. And there are some procedures that could be easily converted to code. There are people particularly in the legal profession that say that smart contracts are misnamed, that they're neither smart nor contracts. But the idea that there could be self-executing contracts, I can absolutely foresee a major role for that. I can imagine that there is possibly work needed to be done on the legal system in this area, but that's a little bit out of my area of expertise.
Okay, Nigel has asked, does the RBA include crypto payments or investments in its consumer payments survey, or does it have plans to in the future?
We did include a question on crypto in our 2019 survey. And that survey showed that less than 1% of the population said they had made a payment over the past year in the form of crypto. And I'm sure we'll include a similar question and maybe other questions in the coming survey, which we've done in 2022.
And Craig has asked, how would moving to wholesale CBDCs and the almost real-time settlement of digital currencies on a 24/7, 365 basis potentially impact on liquidity, either intraday or end-of-day interest?
I think it would have major effects. It would require significant adjustment. But, I think it's still a while off, but I would expect it's a problem that can be solved. What we've done with the NPP is that there is real-time settlement, 24/7, of payments going through the NPP. Now they are often low-value payments, but a payment that's made at 10 o'clock on a Sunday night is settled in real time, and we've been able to set up liquidity arrangements that make that feasible, and so that a greater shift towards 24/7 is presumably something that will happen over time. I don't know if it'll happen over a few years, over a few decades, and it won't be my problem to solve. But the world is moving towards demanding immediacy and towards 24/7 operations, and it's quite possible that wholesale money markets will also have to move in that direction in time. But I don't expect it's something that's going to happen in the near term.
Thank you. So we've got a few more. So we've probably got time for a couple more. So Justin has asked, do you have any observations on the move by CBA to provide a platform for buying and selling of Bitcoin, and also the move by El Salvador to make Bitcoin a legal currency?
On the CBA, that's a decision they've taken. I'd say it's not really an issue for the Reserve Bank. It's more an issue for ASIC and APRA to the extent that it raises regulatory issues. El Salvador is an interesting case. Yes, Bitcoin is legal tender there. So is the US dollar. El Salvador doesn't really have a domestic currency. But at the moment, the US dollar is the dominant currency there. It remains to be seen whether Bitcoin will scale, but I'd say the jury's very much still out on that one. But I do not imagine that you will see other countries with viable domestic currencies adopting Bitcoin as legal tender.
Okay, and I have one last question that we can get to. It's from Clive. Do you care to comment on the reported growth in fraud being part of the issuance plans of new cryptocurrencies?
As I noted in the talk, cryptocurrencies are being used in financial crime in the black economy. They are the payment method of choice for ransoms. It's also a place where it's possible to have a high degree, maybe not perfect anonymity, but a high degree of anonymity in holdings. So I think there are genuine concerns raised about the fact that cryptocurrencies can be used to facilitate financial crime. And I would expect that that's something that the policy authorities, that the authorities around the world, we're paying attention to. It's something that the FATF is looking at, which is the international agency that leads the work. The US FinCEN is also doing a lot of the leading the work globally. So it's absolutely a concern.
Okay, and I do have time for one more question, so I'm quickly going to ask. Does China's planned CBDC mean that Australia also needs to introduce a CBDC?
I don't think it has any particular implications. China's introducing a CBDC for its own particular policy reasons, and that's, I think, that they've seen a shift in financial intermediation and payments moving from the banks, which weren't doing a very good job of it, to the two large technology companies. And I think that they are uncomfortable about that and would like to have a greater role for the central bank and the banking system more generally in payments. So they've decided to introduce the CBDC. The problem of payments shifting to large technology companies and not having a banking system that's providing good payment services, that's not a problem that we have. So I see no particular reason why China's introduction of a CBDC has any implications for why Australia would need one.
Okay, terrific, Tony. On behalf of everybody, thank you very much for your time, expertise and insights today. I've certainly got a lot out of it, and I'm sure everybody else has as well. So thank you, and enjoy your retirement.
Thanks very much, Kurt. It's been a pleasure talking to you all.
Thank you.